announcement because they made the pronouncement of 2B of a possible carcinogen with no evidence, but still it could be because no one can prove that it wasn't. And if one or two people per 100,000 of the six brain tumors per 100,000 that occur in the United States per year, if one or two of them could be proven to be caused by a highly subjective human being, and it was caused by the cell phone usage, would that cause the 305 million cell phones in the United States that are in use right now, would that make us stop using them? 305 million cell phones in the United States with 311 million people. 311 men, women, and children. Obviously, a lot of people have got more than one cell phone. In the case of Russia and a few other countries, the number of cell phones is sometimes 30, 40, and 50% greater than the population. So would we stop using these? No way in hell. With all of the danger we know of cigarette smoking, a hell of a lot of people are still cigarette smoking. So if it makes you feel more comfortable to hold the cell phone further away from your head, go ahead and do that. But you don't have to do it, in my opinion. The numbers are so darn small. By comparison, the 40,000 people per year who die in automobile accidents turns out to be the mathematics of 13 people per year per 100,000 in the population. So automobile...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Automobiles are causing mortality at the rate of 13 per 100,000. The total number of brain tumors is approximately 6 per 100,000. And maybe some percentage of them are due to cell phones. And cell phones give us a hell of a lot of cost-to-benefit ratio, so to speak. In other words, a lot of people are alive because someone was able to call emergency services in a hurry during an automobile accident when somebody hit a telephone pole and they called on their cell phone and got emergency vehicles there in a hurry, and the person got rescued and survived. So, as you can tell, it's a controversial subject. It's based on primarily the vocabulary of that one word, radiation, which I wish we had never used that with radio. We should have called it radio transmitting, radio signaling, radio communication, radio propagation. Should never have called it radiation because of nuclear radiation, and people form an association between the two, and there is none. It's not an apple and orange comparison. I call it an apple and paper comparison. Maybe that answers some of the questions. I'm trying to remember, who was it now? KC2, was it MMY who asked this question? K2RIW? If that was you, Ray, go ahead.
QEO with a couple of comments, I think.
MMY, I have a different question when you're ready.
Very fine, Ray. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, Dick, I think the public is really getting frightened for nothing because, you know, I saw a report on CNN about a week ago. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who's their medical expert, I tried to count the number of times he used the word radiation, and I gave up when I got over 20 times he used the word radiation, and only once did he give a very brief, cursory example of non-ionizing and ionizing radiation. And I keep meaning to look up the word radiation on Wikipedia, but I would say my own definition would be to give off, radiate. You know, we call a car radiator or radiator. Most people call it a radiator. It's really radiator, the word, because it gives off heat. An air conditioner radiates cold. It gives off cold. I think the definition of the word has to be defined. Like you said, the people are equating radiation with nuclear radiation. Nuclear radiation, it gives off ionizing radiation, which this does not. Let me let it reset. Dick, I'll tell you, what concerns me more than the cell phones, I think eventually this is going to come back to bite the hams in the rear end. I got a small taste of this last year. A neighbor next door, he didn't make a big deal, because I know why now, because he sold the house and moved. There's new people there now, and they're very nice people. But he asked me about the antenna in the backyard, which is a Cushcraft R8 vertical, halfway vertical. He said, what about the radiation? My kids play out here. So I gave him the definition of ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think I was too convincing, or he was too happy, but he didn't make a big deal because I later found out he put the house on the market, he moved to Long Island. But I think this is going to come back to bite the hams in the ass. Go ahead, Dick.
If you go to flash.com, which is one of these websites you can go to where current events are being discussed, you will see a report there by somebody called Sipper. Sipper happens to be my son. That's his moniker when he's on Flashdot. He gave a report during his master's degree training over the last year. He gave a report about the radiation hazard of cell sites and cell phones. And in the process, he found quite a few of the ICNIRP and ANSI and all these other standard reports, standard documents traceable to the Bureau from the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers and so on. So in the process of him doing this report for his master's degree subject, he gathered that material and put it on Flashdot because of this WHO report. So if you go to Flashdot right now and you start looking up the subject, one of the people who gave the reports that were rated a number 5, it's a 1-5 system, and people rate the quality of the report, and he got a 5 on it because he didn't only say the words, he documented what he was saying. He said, it says this, and this is the report that says it, and this is the traceability of that report to the Bureau of Standards. So you can read more material by going to Flashdot and looking that up. And as I said, you're really going to be looking up KB2IQN, my son Christopher, who did that report, and he's known as Zipper. So the word radiation really means to give out a signal in all directions. So to radiate is to give out a signal in all directions, and a radio antenna does that. Let me drop. And the process of it radiating a signal in all directions is called radiation. In the case of ionizing radiation, you literally are getting what could be called particles. In other words, the amount of energy per photon of a ionizing radiation, in other words, the breakdown of a nuclear material, you're literally getting protons, neutrons, or electrons coming roaring out of there at nearly the speed of light. These things are really bullets, microscopic, atomic-sized bullets that penetrate your body and do damage on the way, because in some cases they're charged particles, in all cases they've got the high velocity. In many cases, they've got a significant amount of mass, and so they do cellular damage as they penetrate your body, and the effect is accumulative. You take 1 millirem of nuclear radiation today and 1 millirem of nuclear radiation tomorrow, you've had 2 millirems and a little bit less, maybe 1.9 millirems of total bodily damage of that radiation, the cumulative effect. And the reason why it's not quite a perfect sum is because your body does some of the repair in the meantime. Whereas with non-ionizing radiation, the energy per individual particle, individual photon, is so much smaller by something like 10 million to 1, because the frequencies are smaller, and you know what the Planck equation is. It relates frequency to energy per photon. So because the frequency is 10 million times smaller, the energy is 10 million times smaller. And it can do nothing but heating effect. If the RF energy is large enough, it'll do you some heating. But there's no other cumulative effect, and it's truly non-ionizing radiation. And so to compare the two is foolish. And it's just a darn vocabulary word that's driving people crazy. And I can see what's going on here, because unfortunately, let me drop. This is one of the cases where the websites will probably lead you astray. In many cases, you do a Wikipedia research, you'll always come up with an answer, but the majority of the websites you can go to on the subject of RF radiation are in many cases written from an emotional point of view by people who have very little experience. Even when a very respected physician is being interviewed on this subject, if he's a neurosurgeon and you're asking him, do you see an increase in the number of brain tumors because of people using cell phones, he cannot give you that answer. He may be the most honest guy in the world, doing real work day in and day out on brain tumors, but because the rate is so small, 6 per 100,000 in the general population of the United States, and he maybe sees two or three of those people per year, so to speak, can he really make a judgment that's statistically significant? In order to really make the pronouncement, you'd like to have a person who is a respected physician, who has a heavy electrical engineering, particularly RF engineering, background. Well, that human being doesn't exist, because it takes you 12 years of schooling and who knows how many more years of internship and whatever to become a physician. To become a respected radio engineer takes 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship in just that field alone, so you don't get that combination. So if you get a radio engineer making a pronouncement, he's light on medical knowledge. You get a physician making a pronouncement, he's light on engineering knowledge. And he can sound authoritative as all hell. You and I can then go, quote, we can go looking at the websites to try to find further information, and a hell of a lot of what's written there is extremely bad information. Very little of it is good information on this particular subject, because it is so darn emotional. The people who write those articles that you can get a hold of, let me drop, their highest priority is to write an article that pleases the people who are their audience. When it comes to the officials of Huntington Town and Hempstead Town, those particular officials wanted to please their constituency, which is saying, not in my backyard, I don't want that cell site near me. And so they write up moratoriums and zoning laws to try to restrict that. This is one of those situations where you have to ask yourself, if you're a politically influential person, you have to really ask yourself an honest, deep question. Do you give them what they want, or do you give them what they need? You give them what they need, and you will be saving their lives. You give them what they want, you make them happy, but they die. You and I, with not too much difficulty, can come up with a mathematics to talk about the rate of increased human suffering and death that will occur if you restrict the installation of cell site base stations. If the people do not get enough coverage so that they can call emergency vehicles to save lives, people will die. It's an indirect death. It's just a matter of time before some very smart attorney says, aha, this is a case where there isn't sufficient coverage in that town, the emergency services were delayed, therefore the person in that particular automobile accident died, the people who restricted those cell site installations were committing criminally negligent homicide. It's only a matter of time before a smart attorney comes up with a case like that. And then we'll start thinking a little bit differently. So we got a long way to go. You guys in the sound of our voices, let me drop. You guys are the closest things we can get to right now that are radio experts. You're not exactly an expert. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But we know for a fact that radio is our friend. Is there a danger there? A little bit of one. Is it significant? No. The cost-to-benefit ratio is so great that we are going to continue using radios for the rest of our lives. We're going to stop worrying about radio frequency biohazard. 99% of the time, it's a straw man. It's not there. And we have to slowly convince the people in our communities that it is not dangerous. You've got to be very careful how you word it, because if you come on and tell them the absolute honest truth bluntly, they won't accept it. You've got to be more diplomatic than that. But you got to tell them that this is all the evidence that we know of right now. And 60 years of research have gone into that study with radio frequency biohazard by way of the American National Standard Institute study, which has over 1,000 references of the best institutions, the best testing laboratories, and so on. The expert for the United States for the Congress of the United States for about a 15-year period of time was Mr. John Osipchuk of the Raytheon Company in Massachusetts. How did he become an expert? He was an employee of Raytheon. Let me drop. He was an employee of Raytheon working on their Klystrons, Magnetrons, and radar sets. He was in the same department when Mr. Percy Spencer invented the microwave oven. So he was in the right place at the right time. And so how do you get a radio frequency biohazard expert? Well, by some means, he became it. And he was used by Congress for 10 or 15 years as the expert to make these pronouncements in many cases. So by the same token, are any of you guys experts? I think you are. And the main thing you've got to do is teach the public how safe radio is. And then all of this is a tempest in a teapot and a strong misunderstanding of a vocabulary word. And we've got to stop using that word. I know we're not going to do that, but that's the right thing to do, is to stop using that word. The way it's being used is a thoroughly misapplication of the word. Yes, the signal does come out in all directions, therefore it does radiate, and the process is called radiation. But everybody thinks the word radiation means cancer. Everyone thinks the word microwave means cancer. It does not. Pound for pound, microwave frequencies are 5-to-1 safer than VHF frequencies. You say that in front of a zoning board, and they'll say, what planet are you on? That's traceable to the curve of maximum permitted exposure in the ANSI report. It's been there for 50-some-odd years. The microwave frequencies, 10% or 20% of it penetrates, and 80% reflects off your skin. The VHF frequencies, the majority of it penetrates and turns into heat, by the way. So, anybody any further questions or comments on this subject, this emotional subject, give me a call at this, K2RIW.
KC2WIE.
Okay, Rich and WIE in that order. Rich first, go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Well, I was very upset with that CNN report because Dr. Sanjay Gupta he went out of his way to keep saying radiation, 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 using that word. Scare tactics. And you know, there was another scare back in the 80s. I think it was the 80s or the late 70s. Dick, do you remember when they were talking about X-rays out of the back of TV sets from picture tubes, and manufacturers, I don't know if they did it on their own or they were coerced, whatever, that they started putting these horrible metal shields on the tube in the back, which made it very hard to service. Most of the service guys, including myself, would have to take them off, just left them off, because it was ridiculous. So that's really all I have to say, Dick, but like I said, I was very upset with the scare tactics of CNN. 20-some-odd times he used the word radiation, and this is supposed expert, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Back to that.
Yeah. Of the people I know who have been interviewed as engineers to make pronouncements on the subject by people from radio and television, you can tell that they want to emphasize the sensational part of it. There is a kind of a philosophy for people who are in the news business, which is not so honorable, but sometimes it's truthful. The philosophy is, if it bleeds, it leads. It'll be the lead story in the news tonight. If there's blood and gore, if it bleeds. In other words, if it's shocking. So they really are looking for shocking information. They're very bored by somebody making a measurement and find out that everything in the home is safe. They really want to find evidence of how bad things are. Because right now, people will immediately tune to the channel that's giving that kind of information. So we've got a long way to go. Yeah, there's a lot of education. This is a subject that requires education. This is another kind of prejudice. We've had prejudice from people with certain accents and certain skin colors, and now we've got a prejudice with people who use radio and the radio equipment itself. Is it creating a health hazard? And unfortunately, there's a tremendous amount of very bad information, both in writing, but particularly on the websites. The good news is a lot of information there. The bad news is that a hell of a lot of it is purely anecdotal. There are books written on the subject that say it is well known that this damage occurs and that damage occurs. Well, what do you mean by well known? What are the numbers? Who took those numbers? They never tell you. If they're not telling you what are the numbers, who took the numbers, and under what conditions they took the numbers, then it's really a bunch of opinions from somebody who should be authoritative, who writes in such a way where if you don't dig deep enough, it sounds authoritative, but in many cases it is not. Eric, KC2WIE, go right ahead with your question. K2WIE.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You got it, Eric.
Okay, good evening, Dick. I totally agree with you that the evidence is overwhelming, you know, against the likelihood of getting cancer from cellular phone use. However, regarding the Nightline interview with Michael Knox, I would expect he heard from you after that interview, because I got the impression that he kind of choked when asked specifically, does cell phones cause cancer? He offered a soundbite reply stating that there were reports that indicate it does, an equal number of reports stating that it does, and an equal number stating that it doesn't. Did he hear from you regarding the interview? Back to you, Dick.
By the way, I draft Dick to go on TV. What do you say, Dick?
After Mike got those panic calls from ABC Television and from Brooklyn Poly and from the Public Relations Department of Brooklyn Poly, I think he placed either 3 or 4 phone calls to me as he was getting on the train and then getting on the subway to go there. And then he and I talked a number of times afterwards. And yes, he definitely did choke. They hit him cold saying, do cell phones cause cancer? And should we change the standards? If you were hit with that question, Eric, what would you have said?
You know, you had said something about them editing part of his response out, and, you know, I would have thought that he might have offered that answer, you know, and followed up with, however, the studies overwhelmingly indicate the likelihood of getting cancer from cell phone use or remote, something like that. That's the way I would have responded.
But now you've got to put things in context, Eric. I have given testimony on 13 occasions before zoning boards protecting, defending amateur radio operators who are about to put a tower in their backyard, and the zoning board or the community was at first against it. Of those 13 zoning cases, me and the group called Dark, is it called now? Defend Amateur Radio Towers. The group called Defend Amateur Radio Towers, which consisted of Frank Fallon, N2FF, all of a sudden I'm trouble thinking everyone's names that were on our committee. Also, Norm, K2YEW, the guy who is, I'm terrible on names and call letters right now, the guy who is the a television interference expert for Nassau County. Anyhow, we had this group of experts that went around and made these 13 presentations. We won 12 of those cases. And the 13th one, the one that we lost, there's a good explanation as to why we lost it. Let me drop. So the bottom line is that I have been exposed to people with adverse opinions. I've been reading the reports on the subject of radio frequency biohazard and making those presentations, so I've got some experience in that. Mike is a darn good electrical engineer, a very good electrical engineering teacher, teaching at the graduate level students how radio circuits work. That's the good news. That exposure and that experience and that lifetime experience did not give him specific exposure on multiple occasions to the ANSI reports, the ICNIRP reports, and the updates that happen to them periodically. That's out of his normal field of experience. He's the right guy to ask, but he didn't have that specific experience to be able to give a well-informed answer under the cold situation of that particular event, if you know what I mean, back to you, Eric. KC2WIE, K2RIW.
So I take it from your response, Dick, that you went easy on him. All right, thanks for the response, Dick. KC2WIE, back to net.
Okay. If somebody asked you for a subject, for a good explanation for what takes place during neurosurgery, and you've heard a lot of the words, you've read a couple of articles, but they want a specific answer with good documentation on that particular subject. And if I'm unhappy with the answer that you gave, and I don't light into you, am I going easy with you? I mean, you can't blame a person for something they haven't yet been exposed to. Mike's a darn good engineer. He knows how to run instrumentation. But he wasn't completely familiar with all of the nuances of that particular crazy field, radio frequency biohazard. He doesn't teach that subject. He hasn't worked in that subject. So I didn't go easy on him, so to speak. I understood where he was at. And under the circumstances, he did darn well. He could have, I mean, had he made the mistake of saying, wow, look at that. Oh, boy, we're in trouble here. Had he said words like that that were alarming, my goodness, instead of being on at 11:50, he would have been at 11:35. He would have been the very first lead item on Nightline that particular night. But that would be thoroughly inappropriate. I mean, the standard that we have in the United States right now is approximately, I forget the exact number, is it 8 tenths, 9 tenths, whatever. It's approximately 1 milliwatt per square centimeter for maximum permitted exposure for a an uncontrolled situation. Uncontrolled really means that the potential victim doesn't know about it. 1 milliwatt per square centimeter is the current, or something very close to that, is the current standard. And Mike measured 1 milliwatt per square centimeter from that microwave oven at approximately 1.5 or 2 feet from it, which is about where the people are going to operate the oven, but they're not going to sit there for 6 minutes with their eyes open, staring into the microwave oven when it's running full power under that particular condition. They are very safe.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because there's approximately a 100-to-1 safety factor built into the specification. You're about to ask, where did the specification come from? Way back in the 40s, somebody decided to find out, okay, where is the biohazard? They found out for a whole bunch of reasons that the most delicate portion of any mammal is the eye, because the eye has very fine capillaries, very low fluid flow rate. In other words, the ability to cool itself by way of blood flow, the eye has very little cooling capability. And it is the most temperature-sensitive item. If you stood day after day in front of your fireplace, looking at those hot embers on the back of your fireplace while you're burning logs in your living room, the thermal energy coming off of that fireplace has a high probability of giving you a cataract because of the heating of your cornea. That's the truth. Talk to eye surgeons and you'll find some confirmation of that. So when it comes to radio energy giving a thermal heating effect, the radio energy hitting the cornea of your eye could, if it creates enough heating, give you eventually a cornea, and the eye doesn't have a good temperature sensing so that you don't even know your eye is running hot at the time you're getting the exposure, so to speak. Okay, so they found this all out, and they decided to do an experiment. You're not going to do the experiment on a human being. They took a rabbit, clamped him down into a structure, clamped him into a structure so that he couldn't move his head, clamped his eyelids open so that this red eye of a white rabbit is staring straight up. They aimed a microwave horn at him, and they started increasing the power, and they did this experiment a couple of days in a row. Let me drop. And they find out that for that particular rabbit, the threshold of him getting a cataract was approximately 100 milliwatts, 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. And you came to the conclusion that a human eye and the rabbit's eye have strong similarity, very similar structure and cross-section, very similar fluid flow rates and whatever. And so if you stared into 100 milliwatts per square centimeter for 6 solid minutes, that's the thermal time constant of a human eye, and a rabbit's eye is something very close to that. If you stared with your eye open into a feed horn with 100 milliwatts per square centimeter for 6 solid minutes, there's a medium probability you will develop a cataract. Well, that takes a whole comedy of errors to do it. And so the standard right now is 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, which is 100 to 1 safer than that number, averaged over 6 minutes. You can see where it comes from, and so that even if your microwave oven hits that number, does that mean you're going to go blind tomorrow? Very unlikely. And so Mike has some of that information. He knew that what was measured was slightly alarming by the current American National Standards Institute standard, which, by the way, used to be 10 milliwatts per square centimeter for a whole lot of years. And recently they got more conservative because more and more people are hollering, and they didn't have real measurements to confirm it. Just to keep everybody happy, they went down to 10 when it used, down to 1 when it used to be 10. So Mike was not alarmed by that, but could he sit there saying that everything in his house is perfectly safe? No. It was sort of a gray zone, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Eric. KC2WIE, K2LIW.
Your points are well taken, Dick. Thank you. KC2 back, WIE back to net.
And with any further questions or comments on radio frequency biohazard, it is a darn good subject to discuss, even though we've discussed it a number of times in the past. To discuss it more in the future, I think, is appropriate, because the people who are going to educate the public as to how good radio is are the guys that are listening to us right now. You guys are the experts. They're the closest things we got to experts. We've got to slowly educate that public that radio is their friend. It's good. It's not bad. You try to eliminate radio, and people will die. As simple as that. I mean, the canary is out of the cage. The story is out. Cell phones work, and there's 5 billion of them being used in the world right now. And until you find something that is really definitive, that is really clear, black and white, that is doing damage to people, you're not going to be eliminating them. We've got something that's 3 or 4 times more damaging if you take the worst possible statistics of brain tumors. I'm talking about automobile deaths. We kill 3 or 4 times as many people as you can possibly guess in the worst case with brain tumors. We're killing them that many times higher with automobiles, and we're not outlawing automobiles. And what's killing them is, in many cases, telephone poles. And we don't outlaw telephone poles. We don't even move them further away from the roads and put protective devices around them. And we claim that we don't want any more cell sites in our town because they're unsightly. And we don't even see all of those utility poles every 150 feet down every single street that we've got, with rare exception where there's underground wiring. And so the thing that is damaging people, we don't see. The thing that is saving people, we're trying to eliminate. We've got to stop doing that. Any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters, K2LIW. Okay, let's get into the deeper stuff. And I've got a series of questions here with reference to Wesley's latest email. Some of it is on the Thompson experiment. What J.J. Thompson did around 1906, and there was a series of letters that flowed back and forth between him and Tesla on the subject of putting high voltage, so to speak, or magnetic fields or oscillating magnetic fields inside of an evacuated glass envelope and seeing glowing of the glass that's inside, of the gases that are inside. And part of what's going on there, in my opinion, let me drop, is that the word vacuum is a very relative thing. The vacuum tubes that I was using on the first transmitter that I built, and I bet you Mel can confirm this, He and I were using something equivalent to a 6L6 tube. Mine was a transistorized, it was a tube transmitter, one tube transmitter, 25 watts, 6L6 tube, running at the 40 meter handband, 7.15 megacycles roughly. And when you press down the key, and that tube was producing 25 watts of power, in the dark room, you would see a blue glow around the anode, the plate of that particular tube. It was a beam pentode tube, 6L6, beam tetrode, beam pentode. And because the vacuum in there was imperfect, and because a significant number of electrons during that radio transmission were flowing from the cathode to the plate, and they were encountering the small amount of air molecules that were there, you got a blue glow inside of that tube. I bet you saw that when you were operating the tube in your youth. I bet you we got something else in common here, Mel. Let me pass it over to you for a comment on this one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Mike Gangi, I think you forgot about me. You know, it was a fact that you know, with those days of, like you say, vacuum tubes, the things that we did, or should say, got away with, it was a, you know, considerably different world from what we have today. The 6L6, as you say, was a popular tube. I had that as my one tube rig. It was a crystal controlled on, but mine was on 80 meters because I happened to get a crystal that was on sale at the time for 3.725. I'll never even forget the frequency. And the 6L6 was actually categorized as a beam power amplifier. And so it was the 6L6 was invented back basically in the late 30s, and during World War II it underwent a transformation and became 807s, because what they did is move the plate to a plate cap on top of the tube so that it would be more liable for making it into a transmitting power amplifier. But yes, like you say, with approximately, oh, I don't remember, about 360 to 400 volts on the plate, and I think the grid, about 270 on the grid, I believe it, realistically, if, I don't know, what did you say, 19, 20 watts over?
Yeah, but when you press down the key and you look into the glass envelope, do you remember seeing a blue glow around the plate of that tube or in between the plate? Depending on how much silvering you've got on the end of the tube, and one of mine was a 6W6, as I remember, as you looked past the silvering and you looked down the axis of the vacuum tube itself, you would see a blue glow that went on and off as you pressed down the key. I wonder if you saw that, Mel. Go ahead.
The factor was the way you tested. If you found the 6L6, the ones that glowed the least was supposedly the better tube. It was the other way around. The word got out that the older, you know, 6L6s that already were kind of in the greatest shape, the ones that most of the hams I got, how did I inherit 6L6s? I had an uncle that worked in the jukebox business, and they used them in the amplifier, so I used to beg them, you know, they serviced. They just would change tubes galore, and the thing worked fine. If it didn't, they didn't bother putting the old tubes back on. Oh, I'd say, please save me. You know, save me the tubes. And the tube, oh, boy, 5U4s and 6L6s, Dick, over.
Yeah, Ray is right. We did skip over him. KC2, Mike Yankee. What's going on in Yonkers tonight, Ray? Go ahead.
Hi, Dick. Good evening. I mean, I had a totally different question just with regard to 6 meters. I'd like to know why I never get anything. I know the band closes. I've tried different antennas, but I mean, I believe that I should get something. The radio's working because I test it with my MFJ, you know, oscillator. So it receives and everything, but maybe you can give me a little heads up on how I can hear something on 6 meters. I got an ICOM 551.
Okay, I believe this is the weekend of the June contest. I'm not positive of that. I do know that a few of my buddies were listening on 6 meters and hearing a lot of activity this afternoon, particularly on the Morse code sections of the band. So the activity is there, and if this is the June contest weekend of AR or RIL, and you can easily confirm that, everything from 2 o'clock in the afternoon today up until, I think it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon tomorrow, continuously, there will be a lot of 6-meter activity. So if your antenna and rig is working, you should be hearing all kinds of signals, more now than any other time during the year, except the September contest and the January contest. So the first thing you've got to ask yourself is that your 551, what is its sensitivity? Do you have a good piece of feed line? And what are you using for an antenna, and where is the antenna located? I remember my first 6-meter contact was using a simple dipole, which is not much of an antenna, strung between trees, and I was living out in Middle Island at the time. And my first contact was a guy in Smithtown, which was, 20 or so miles away. Do you hear ignition static? In the case of a... Let me drop...
Comments.
In the case of a reasonably well-operating 6-meter transceiver in the receive mode, you've got to be hearing from time to time ignition noise from automobiles, 60-cycle power line noise. If somebody's running a lawnmower, you've got to hear some noises from it. You've got to be hearing noises if you've got a sensitive receiver. If you hear nothing but pure white noise from the receiver and you hear no man-made noise under any conditions, then you've got to stop asking. You've got to start asking yourself, is my antenna working? What is its standing wave ratio? What's the feed line loss? Where's the antenna located? And so on. You've got to be hearing noise. Who's the person who said comment? Tell me what you think about 6 meters right now. Go ahead. K2RIW, give me your call letters and name, sir.
Evening, Dick. This is Bennett, KO2OK in New Jersey. The contest starts next Saturday, 2 p.m. through Sunday, 11 p.m. And you should be able to hear some beacons. And you can always, attach his antenna and detach his antenna, and he should hear a difference in noise. But there are local beacons that he should be able to pick up down around 0685 or 074 for local beacons. I like 6 meters very much. I've got it on the background now, and it was open to Europe and South America, Portugal today at various times. But other times it's very dead, and you don't hear anything except the local beacons. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, darn good information, Bennett. So if he tunes to 50.065 and 50.074 in that region, he should be hearing beacons. He's living in Yonkers, and I think you're saying there are beacons in New Jersey and Long Island that are, or at least within the Yonkers vicinity. He should be able to hear those beacons, and I'm going to turn it back to you, Bennett, for a confirmation of that. KO2OK, K2RIW on the TechNet.
About 50.086, Dick.
Very fine. Rich, go ahead, Bennett.
Well, it's K2ZD. Mario's beacon is 0685, 50.0685, around there. There is a Long Island beacon that's temporarily around 079 or 078. I think it's only temporarily there until he fixes it. You can hear the beacon in the background. That's K2ZD. And then there's, it's an NL7, even though they're not in Alaska. They're here in FN20, our local grid square, around 074. So there are a couple of beacons around that he should be able to pick up, even with a simple vertical or maybe if he's got a Yagi antenna. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Rich and Bernie. So if with your antenna you tune around for a few nights and don't hear any of those beacons and don't hear any of the human beings, the next thing to worry about, Eric, is your feed line an open circuit? Does it have reasonable standing wave ratio? Does it have reasonable loss? Is there water in it? Is the antenna connected? And is the receiver of your 551 producing normal sensitivity? Now, one of the other things you got to worry about is that many of the rigs that we can buy made in Southeast Asia are really kind of dead in the front end before you add a preamplifier. I'm going to turn it over to Bennett first. Bennett, if he was using a Barefoot 551 without a preamplifier, I think he would still hear beacons, but he's going to hear them a hell of a lot better with a preamplifier. Is that approximately what you find, Bennett? KO2OK, K2RIW.
It says KO2OK. I believe you're right. I've had the 551, I've had the 275. They're, of course, better with the AG25 ICOM preamp or some other brand of preamp. But he should make sure his RF gain is all the way up for reception. And if he disconnects his antenna, he should hear a difference between connecting an antenna and not having the antenna connected. There should be a difference in noise level. That could be a telltale sign that something else is going on, either with the receiver or the antenna. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a darn good test, Bennett. When a good low-noise amplifier is working correctly, it is impedance-sensitive, as well as being sensitive to very weak signals. So when you've got the antenna connected and the receiver is seeing something close to 50 ohms resistive, as opposed to an open circuit, there should be a significant change in noise amplitude that you hear coming out of the loudspeaker, assuming the RF gain is set up all the way it should be. And on top of that, when you do connect the outside antenna, not only with the magnitude of noise change, you should start hearing man-made noises. When the noise blanker is turned off, you should be hearing clicks and pops of electrical switches going on and off in the neighborhood, in the house. You should be hearing power line noise, ignition noise from automobiles. There's all kinds of noises you should be hearing if you have a state-of-the-art receiver. I wonder if that's what you hear on your situation, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
N2EO, Dick. Yeah, I typically, if I take the antenna off the rig, and you ask me to drop to zero, well, you know, down to the bottom, if I put the antenna on, I'm getting S4 static. If I swing it towards Manhattan, it'll sometimes jump up around a 6, S6. And I do not have a preamp on 6. I found a preamp on 6, at least with what I'm using. I don't know about the 551. It's not necessary. On 2 meters, a preamp helps a little bit. On 432 and 1296, it's mandatory. But I'm using the Collins 62S1 transmitter driven with a KWM2. And yes, the band was open today. I wonder where the gentleman is listening, because all the activity on sideband is at the bottom of the band. The first 100 kilohertz, 50 to 50.1 by FCC regulation, is A1, CW only, no sideband allowed. 50.125, 50.125 is the calling frequency, and 50.1 is the DX window. So these are the places he should be listening.
Okay, that's pretty good information. So what do you hear when you connect and disconnect the antenna, Ray? And have you heard anything yet on that band? KC2, Mike Yankee, K2RIW in the group.
K2LIW, K2 Mike Yankee. Okay, let me tell you what I got. I got a half wavelength, just a piece of wire, basically, hanging off the balcony. I'm up on the second floor. I did at one time, used to turn the radio on and hear a lot of noise, but I don't hear that noise anymore, and there's not much difference when I disconnect the antenna. I wanted to test if it received, so I got the MFJ, the standard, you know, SWR tester, and obviously that oscillates and transmits in a form, so if you walk across the room and you hit 50 megahertz with it, you'll hear the radio squeal. So we know it's receiving, we just don't know how sensitive it is. And I do recall jiggling the antenna in the back at one time to have to do that to get it to work. So I'm thinking now maybe something did happen to the radio. I have heard code and people talking once or twice on the radio since I've had it. And I've had it for a few years. You know, I've turned it on now and again. Basically, that's the setup. And I guess some questions I have, are we talking about what mode? CW? Are we talking about upper sideband? AM? What are we talking about? Okay, I guess that's it. Over. Okay.
Yeah, all the Morse code on 6 meters is between 50.0 and 50.1. The lower 100 KC of the band by FCC agreement is only used for Morse code. From 50.1 and above, a little bit of Morse code exists, but most of it is upper single sideband. Very little AM, very little FM in that portion of the band. So single sideband above 50.1, with 50.125 being the calling frequency, or is it 50.150, one or the other. So either 25 or 50 KC above 50.1 is the calling frequency. 50.1, according to Rich, is the international DX frequency. And so those are what you should be listening for. The fact that you have to jiggle that connector to get response is something that you should look into. Open up the rig and find out if you've got a cold solder joint or something like that there is one thing to look for. Second of all, let me drop. You'd be better off making a real half-wave dipole fed with a piece of coax cable in the center with maybe a poor man's balun, a couple of turns of the coax taped together right at the dipole, acting as a balun structure, an RF choke, so that RF current doesn't flow down the outside of the coax cable. That's going to give you a better antenna. A half wavelength of wire hanging down from your balcony means that you're feeding the outer end of a half wave of wire where the impedance is 1,500 ohms. And you've got a 1,550 ohm rig going into a 1,500 ohm antenna when you feed it that way. So it's a rather poor impedance match. And so you can make a definite improvement on that antenna, and eventually, if you're not starting to hear beacons and people, particularly next weekend when the June contest is going to be in full swing, starting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, if you don't hear a hell of a lot of activity, because you're in the major metro area where there's a lot of guys on Long Island, New York City, and in New Jersey and Connecticut that are on 6 meters. During the June contest, 6 meters is one of the bands where they rack up a lot of their points. There's going to be activity. If not, it's time for you to put that rig onto a signal generator and measure its sensitivity. Its sensitivity should be something like minus 120 dBm in the single sideband mode. That's something like 0.15 microvolts, 0.1 microvolts. Around minus 120 dBm should be the sensitivity if that receiver is really cranking before you add a preamp. And then when you add a preamp, it's going to be quite a bit more lively yet. So it looks like you've got a couple more experiments to run there to find out what's happening as I see it, Ray. KC2, Mike Yankee, K2LIW.
K2LIW. Yeah, I do have a tuner and I can tune the wire. Half a wavelength, about 10 feet, so it's, you know, something somewhat substantial. And I have the option here of turning on the MFJ. What do I got, a 10? I can't read it. I can't see anymore. 1040C, but it has 50. You can amplify 50 megahertz with it. I guess, okay, so I got a lot of good information. It looks like something might be broken. I don't know what. I do have a 2-year degree in electronics, but heck if I remember anything to get the scope out and stuff. What do you think could have blown on this thing? And what else could I ask? Also want to know, in general, even if there's no contest, should you be able to hear people generally on any given night on 6 meters? That was kind of the main question.
Okay, we've got two guys on frequency right now who occupy that band. Bennett and Rich, in that order. We're going to go to them. And I am guessing, particularly on Monday night when the Pack Rats have everybody sign in to the Monday night get-together, and I'm guessing to get on 6 meters, something like 7:30. So starting at around 7 o'clock, 7:30, almost every night, I think there's going to be some activity on 6 meters in the metropolitan area. What do you think, Bennett? KO2OK, K2RIW.
This is KO2OK. Actually, Dick, I don't think I've listened to them or heard them. I don't know when they're on. If they're the pack rats, and they've done Philadelphia, I don't know how many local check-ins they have. But there is a local 6-meter net that meets on Wednesday night in northern Jersey on 50.135. They call themselves the Millennium Net, the 6-meter Millennium Net. And it's going on since before the year 2000. They meet for at least an hour every Wednesday night. So it's 50.135. Some people are in Hackensack and Teaneck and maybe a little bit further south and west. But a number of people check in there. But, you know, if the band's dead and there's no net going on, it can be pretty quiet, except maybe for the beacons, if you have an antenna good enough to hear the beacons. So, sometimes it is very quiet, Dick. Back to you.
Bennett, the Millennium Net meets on Wednesday night, 50.135. Tell me once again, now, what time do they meet? What time do they start? 7:30?
It's 9 o'clock, I believe. 9 o'clock because it overlaps one of our baronets that we have on 2 meters. And some of the people like to check in into both nets. So it's 9 o'clock on Wednesday evening.
Very good information. Rich, when do you hear the maximum activity on 6 meters? N2EO, K2RIW?
Okay, Dick. Well, it depends on the time of the year. In the winter, it's absolutely dead. But this time of year, there's a lot of activity. Even in midday, I'm retired, and, you know, the band's been opening up. And starting pretty much more than half the time now, midday, 12, 1, 2 o'clock, you start getting bursts out of the Midwest or out of the South. Marginal openings to major openings, depending on the day. I want to correct those frequencies. You know, I got to picture my dial mentally in my head. 50.125. That is the major calling frequency, and that's where the gentleman should listen most days. 50.125, and the DX frequency for Europe is 50.110. I'll make him an offer. Let me let it reset. You know, not in the best of health, but I have my good days and bad days. He sends me an email, N2EO at ARRL, don't use ARRL, use N2EO at nyc.rr.com. What I'll do, I'm not going to fix his radio, but I can put it on the service monitor. I have a WaveTech 3000B. I can run it up on the service monitor and tell him if something is dead in the front end of that radio. Most of these Jap radios use something like a 3SK40 MOSFET in the front end. He may have a blown gate on that transistor. I can check that in a couple of minutes, Dick.
You could also send him a signal and see how well you're hearing him, because from your area, Rich, to Yonkers is a short hop, and that should be a gangbuster signal. So you guys could meet on the air. If he doesn't hear you, then it's time to start finding out what's wrong with his rig. Back to you, Rich.
Absolutely, Dick. That's a very obvious idea. Let him, send me an email, N2EO at ARRL. I keep saying ARRL. I don't like to use that reflector. I had some problems with mail being hijacked and sent to from N2EO at ARRL.net. It got hijacked and was being sent to an unknown address on I forget if it was Yahoo or MSN, so I don't use that anymore. N2EO at nyc.rr.com. Send me an email. I'll send you a signal on 6 meters, and if you don't hear it, maybe we can get together. It'll take me 5 minutes. We'll plug the radio into a WaveTech 3000B. Run the generator up and get a look at it. Back to that.
That's an attractive offer. Out of curiosity, NYC is obviously NewYorkCity.RR.com. What does the RR stand for, Rich? Radio Research?
Roadrunner. NYCRoadrunner.com. It's the cable system.